$250 million for Greece, $150 million for Turkey.
A number of policymakers often uttered arguments which could be most closely paraphrased in the following fashion, that if Greece and Turkey go, Western Europe and perhaps the Middle East will go, as these areas are removed from the world economy and from the world system, the United States will be economically isolated and will have returned to the Depression of the 1930s.
This is Barton Bernstein, Associate Professor of History at Stanford, a Truman Scholar, and one of the country's leading younger historians.
Now, the curious thing about the Truman Doctrine is, why was there a global pronouncement for a set of issues and facts which could be interpreted in a more limited framework? And that raises another curious question, and that is, did we know that Britain was going to pull out? The answer is, we'd known for quite a while that Britain resources were short and that Britain would have to abandon this section of the Middle East. In fact, Truman and his Secretary of State Burns in 46 had already made informal agreements with the Greek government to provide American economic aid. What the occasion of March 47 offered, after the British in February had informed us officially of imminent withdrawal, was the opportunity of mobilizing anti-communism in America, not simply for the cases of Greece and Turkey, but for the larger commitment to foreign aid and to reconstruction of Europe. That it was a broad-based revolution, often led by communists. But communists were not always a dominant and not always a majority force. Secondly, the revolution was, rather than supported by Stalin, opposed by Stalin. In fact, there is information in Gillis's memoirs in which Gillis, then an ardent Yugoslavian revolutionary, expresses his great dismay and disappointment when he learned from Stalin that Stalin, whom he perceived as a great revolutionary, was indeed a counter-revolutionary and was trying to stop the revolution in Greece. The implication was, in order to seek a modus vivendi with the West and with the United States in particular, and the revolution was threatening and disruptive.
The tone of the Truman speech, stressing not the geopolitical balance of power but anti-communism, surprised many, including Truman's own Secretary of State at the time, General George C. Marshall. Charles Bolin, a career diplomat then on his way to Moscow with Marshall, wrote, "When we received the text of the president's message, we were somewhat startled to see the extent to which the anti-communist element of the speech was stressed. Marshall sent back a message to President Truman questioning the wisdom of this presentation, saying he thought Truman was overstating the case a bit. The reply came back that from all his contacts with the Senate, it was clear that this was the only way in which the measure could be passed." So writes Charles Bolin. I asked Barton Bernstein if the diaries, archives, and papers of the period indicate that Truman understood the realities and was soft-soaping the public, or if he stood behind his own rhetoric.
Truman did publicly exaggerate even his own conception of the so-called menace, although his own conception itself, I think, was an exaggeration of the reality, as indicated by presently available evidence, and as indicated even then by some evidence which was misinterpreted or incorrectly perceived. That is to say that finding a revolution in Greece and seeing communists involved in the revolutionary movement, there was an immediate assumption that it was largely communist, and furthermore, that it was Soviet-directed. Each of these interpretations obviously was shaped more by ideology than by evidence, and it's significant that wherever the evidence was ambiguous, the administration never admitted it publicly and simply resolved all matters in favor of anti-communism. Secondly, and I think at least as important, is the fact that the administration found that it could not sell foreign aid programs in terms of its own conception of a multilateral trade world, but could sell them, or possibly could sell them, by casting them within an anti-communist framework.
Perhaps the most significant piece of European diplomacy during Truman's first administration was the Marshall Plan. In his memoirs, Truman describes the plan as a measure of American aid intended to promote European recovery through the principle of self-help. If the nations of Europe, he wrote, could be induced to develop their own solution of Europe's economic problems, viewed as a whole and tackled cooperatively, rather than as separate national problems, United States aid would be more effective and the strength of a recovered Europe would be better sustained. At the time, this was the generally accepted view. Since then, revisionist historians, looking at the origins of the Cold War, have developed other opinions. One of these historians is Ronald Steele, hardly a radical, more appropriately, a disillusioned 60s liberal. He writes, "The Marshall Plan is, of course, considered an unprovocative act of enlightened self-interest that saved Western Europe from falling into the communist orbit. But at the time, many Europeans, despite the economic crisis they were facing, feared American assistance presented in a form that might antagonize Moscow. As Lewis Halley has observed in The Cold War as History, quote, when the offer of rescue came at last in the form of the Marshall Plan, it undoubtedly did contribute to the final fall of Czechoslovakia and its incorporation in the Russian Empire. To Stalin's mind, the Marshall Plan, coming hot on the heels of the Truman Doctrine, was a design for an anti-communist Western Europe backed up by American military power. This, one recalls, was at a moment when the United States still had an atomic monopoly and when certain high officials in the government were calling for a preventive nuclear strike against the Soviet Union. We cannot know what effect a different American posture would have had on Stalin's plans. But from the record available to us, it seems clear that the hardening American attitude reinforced traditional Russian fears of isolation by hostile forces and led the Kremlin to tighten its grip on the territories already under its control. The Russians rejected Washington's call to cooperate in the European recovery program and forbade their satellites from participating, just as Washington expected they would. Russia's rejection was greeted with relief in Washington and saved the Marshall Plan from almost certain congressional dismemberment. The breach was widened.
The Marshall Plan, which is generally judged to have been launched by Secretary of State George Marshall's speech in early June of 1947, was a curious speech.
Again, Barton Bernstein.
In that it had no anti-communism within it. It was directed in large measure at Europeans and not at Americans. And indeed, the British had been tipped off in advance and told that it was the beginnings of the possibility of large-scale economic aid and to seize the opportunity. Unfortunately, it, however, was a carefully contrived program in a way that has only recently become susceptible to proof. And that is to say that the Marshall Plan was conceived so the Soviets could not accept it. Though Marshall claimed that it was not directed against any country, and privately at one point he suggested or agreed that indeed we should play the policy straight, the Marshall Plan would, among other things, have required the Soviets to be a donor rather than a recipient nation. It also would have required the Soviets to move toward a form of economic multilateralism, which for our purposes would have meant the abolition of state trading and indeed the destruction of a socialist economy. Furthermore, it would have required all participant nations, and did require participant nations, to provide access to the physical terrain and also to secret economic data upon which the Soviets judged their security partly depended. Furthermore, the Marshall Plan called for treating Eastern Europe, then in many cases Soviet satellites, as primarily agrarian producers and reorienting those producers into a flow of trade with Western Europe and therefore away from the Soviet Union. So in all these ways, the Marshall Plan was eminently unacceptable, and we knew it would be unacceptable to the Soviet Union. Domestically, the Marshall Plan was sold basically on three counts. One, it would provide the reconstruction of Western Europe upon which the American economy depended. Two, it would stop subversion within Western Europe by ending the conditions of chaos and economic disintegration. And since we believe that communists flourished in these conditions, it would stop the communist parties. Privately, we also used Marshall Plan aid to to shove communist parties out of Western European governments as being necessary to halt communism and to halt the Soviet Union by creating a strong Western Europe as a buffer to expansion. In March of 1948, the administration even generated and encouraged some war scares to suggest that the crisis was imminent and immediate action had to be taken by the Congress. In fact, in general, in the early post-war years, no policymaker, with the exception probably of James Forrestal, the Secretary of Defense, believed that the Soviets were likely militarily to expand in the imminent future into Western Europe. The Soviet threat was always seen as more long range, more distant, and in its early stages, non-military. In that sense, the interpretation sold to the American people departed not only from the facts, but from the administration's own private understanding.
Which leaves the question, which I put to Professor Bernstein, to what extent was the Cold War confrontation in Europe the collision of two expanding spheres of influence, and to what extent was it avoidable?
I think these clashes are avoidable in the sense that one can choose to act or not to act, to accommodate or to achieve a modus vivendi. It happened that the modus vivendi proffered was one which was unacceptable to American ideology and to the American conception of national interest. It's not clear, however, that we would have acted as we did if we had not believed that we possessed the effective weapons for changing the situation, and in a sense, between 45, 46, for liberating Eastern Europe. That is to say that Roosevelt, who I think shared the same ideology as Truman, Roosevelt who shared pretty much the same State Department as Truman, Roosevelt who, in a sense, bestowed his advisors upon Truman with some shifts in 1945, nevertheless had achieved an uneasy modus vivendi in late 44 and early 45, and it's this which Truman overturned in Eastern Europe. He did so, I think, not out of impulse, and not so much because advisors were urging him to do so, but because he believed that he had the weapons which could make the difference.
The world's largest airfield on Tinian in the Marianas. The voice you hear is that of Chaplain William Downey, who stood amongst the target charts, the escape kits, and the stale coffee, and said a prayer for the Enola Gay and civilization.
We pray thee that the end of the war may come soon, and that once more we may know peace on earth. May the men who fly this night be kept safe in thy care, and may they be returned safely to us. We shall go forward trusting in thee, knowing that we are in thy care now and forever. In the name of Jesus Christ, amen.
The bomb run lasted 4 minutes. The bomb went away at 9:15. My God, was the only entry in the co-pilot's diary. 78,150 people died at Hiroshima.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
It was 6 weeks after Roosevelt's death that Truman was informed that the A-bomb was an operative weapon. A committee, including scientists who had been working on the bomb project, representatives of the military and the State Department, recommended that the bomb be used as soon as possible. In his memoirs, Truman wrote, "It was their recommendation that the bomb be used without specific warning and against a target that would clearly show its devastating strength. I realized, of course, that an atomic bomb explosion would inflict damage and casualties beyond imagination. On the other hand, the scientific advisors of the committee reported, quote, "We can propose no technical demonstration likely to bring an end to the war. We see no acceptable alternative to direct military use." The Americans, British, and Nationalist Chinese delivered an ultimatum to the Japanese demanding unconditional surrender on the evening of July 26th. The ultimatum mentioned full military power, but nothing about super weapons or bombs. On July 28th, Radio Tokyo said Japan would fight on. On August 5th, Truman, on his way home from the Potsdam Conference in Germany, received the following cable aboard the USS Augusta, the ship on which he was traveling. "Big bomb dropped on Hiroshima. First reports indicate complete success." The question which has to be asked is, did Truman have any real choice?
Oh, I think in theory, the bomb either could have been used differently or not at all. I think in terms of the context of the time, the subtle pressures on him and the assumptions which he inherited, what he did is hardly surprising, though less than inevitable. And let me explain what I mean. Roosevelt, of course, had created the project, had purposely concealed it from the Soviets. We had an elaborate security network, devised only partly to keep it from the Germans, and after the middle of 1944, the preeminent concern was not that it be kept from the Germans, who we knew were no longer working on the bomb, but that it be kept from the Soviets. Truman inherited the policy of concealment, as well as Roosevelt's assumption that the bomb was a legitimate weapon and would be used to end the war and presumably to save American lives. It would have taken a man, I think, far more knowledgeable, far more confident, and with a different set of moral assumptions, who would have been deeply troubled by the assumption he had inherited and prepared to reverse that assumption. In fact, neither he nor anyone of significant prominence in the administration and close to the decision-making on the bomb was prepared to seek to reverse that assumption. That is, all assumed the bomb would be used. We must remember that this was a nation in 1945 which not only overwhelmingly would support and did support the use of the bomb, but already one which had grown morally calloused to the notions of using weapons to kill civilians as an instrument of war. I mean, Dresden and the firebomb raids on Japan were just two notable examples of a policy which was one of already of more than 2 years of age at this time.
Among the leading critics of Truman's decision to drop the bomb is Gar Alperovitz, a revisionist historian. In his book, Atomic Diplomacy, Alperovitz argues that the bomb was intended to intimidate the Soviets rather than to save American lives, as was the contention. Alperovitz goes on, drawing upon archives and diaries of those involved in the decision, that Truman went ahead with the A-bomb in order to minimize Soviet influence in Europe. This part of his thesis is, obviously, controversial. Less controversial is the fact that Truman did postpone the Potsdam Conference twice and stiffened his position on Eastern Europe during the period between Roosevelt's death and the Japanese surrender. I asked Professor Bernstein what he thought of Alperovitz's ideas.
Partly right, but I think if one puts the evidence he uses into a different context, it comes out this way. Given the fact that Truman inherited assumptions which he did not want to reverse, which would have been difficult to challenge and where he had no moral incentive to challenge, he was prepared to use the bomb and in fact comfortably countenanced using it. In addition, the bomb offered other advantages, namely to give the Soviets pause in Eastern Europe, or as James Burns remarked when Leo Szilard, the protesting scientist, saw him roughly a month before the bomb was used, the bomb would make the Soviets more manageable in Eastern Europe. In addition, there's also another theme, though, suggesting why the bomb was used, and it's revealed by Truman in a letter that he wrote to a prominent clergyman explaining Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and written about a day or two after Nagasaki. And he put it this way. He said, when you're dealing with beasts, you have to treat them like beasts. And that, it seems to me, is a very revealing comment. Because he wasn't simply saying that the war had to be ended, that we didn't want to lose American lives, and that perhaps some more American lives would have been lost if we had delayed or not used the bomb. But rather, there was also, it seems to me, a desire suggested by that letter, clearly written by him and not by a secretary, that retribution was itself attractive. When you're dealing with beasts, you have to treat them like beasts, he said. And he had, in the same letter, he referred to Pearl Harbor and the sneaky attack on Pearl Harbor. And it seems to me that it is not a straining of the evidence to find in that letter very clearly the theme of retribution.
Is there any evidence that the fact that it was an Oriental nation that was going to be bombed, that this made it easier? I'm talking now not about Roosevelt, but about Truman.
There's no direct evidence on the matter. One can only reach any conclusion on that through an admittedly strained reading of the evidence. And I think the right-minded people can easily come to directly contradictory interpretations. I'm personally convinced that we would have used the bomb on Germany if it had been available. It was clear, however, by early 44, especially when we believe the Germans would be surrendering by the middle or late 44, that the bomb was going to be used on Japan, that it wouldn't be ready for Germany, and that indeed the expectation was the Japanese war would certainly endure long enough to use the bomb. It's probably true that it made it easier for men not to reconsider their assumptions because the Japanese were Oriental. But I don't think if they had been Caucasian that the assumption would have been reconsidered and reversed.
The second major Far Eastern event of Truman's presidency was the Korean War. Again, the questions raised about Truman's policy center around the aptness of his response to the North Korean attack upon South Korea. The administration placed the war on the setting of international communist expansionism. In his memoirs, Truman says that he viewed Korea as early as 1948 as, quote, one of the places where the Soviet-controlled communist world might choose to attack. Historians critical of Truman have pointed out that it was this magnification of the struggle that resulted in the limited Chinese-American war in Korea. Ronald Steele writes in an essay about Dean Acheson, Truman's Secretary of State, when North Korean troops streamed across the 38th parallel on June 24, 1950, Acheson immediately blamed the Russians and considered it another testing of American will. It seemed close to certain that the attack had been mounted, supplied, and instigated by the Soviet Union, he writes, and that it would not be stopped by anything short of force. Truman saw it as the potential opening shot of World War III, and in his memoirs he wrote, every decision made in connection with the Korean War had this one aim in mind, to prevent a third world war and the terrible destruction it would bring to the civilized world. Dean Acheson apparently never considered the possibility that the causes of the war might have been based to a large extent on local factors, on the weaknesses of Syngman Rhee's repressive South Korean government, his threats to march on the North, the belief of the North Koreans that they could unify the country easily, that, as Professor Stephen Ambrose of the Naval War College has stated, the Chinese never wanted the war and did not support the North Koreans until MacArthur forced them to do so. The same was true for the Russians, who had no hand in the initial attack. For Acheson, the attack was, quote, an open, undisguised challenge to our internationally accepted position as the protector of South Korea, close quote. Although Acheson considered American prestige, continuing with Steele's narrative, to be involved, prior to the invasion there was no commitment to the defense of Korea. Indeed, It had been explicitly omitted from the United States defense perimeter by Acheson himself and by the Pentagon. In War and Peacetime, General J. Lawton Collins, Army Chief of Staff during the Korean War, reminds us that in April 1948, President Truman and the Joint Chiefs of Staff approved a policy stating, "The United States should not become so irrevocably involved in the Korean situation that an action taken by any faction in Korea or by any other power in Korea could be considered a cause of war for the United States." The Joint Chiefs of Staff felt that, in the context of a general war, Korea was indefensible and of little strategic value to the U.S. They recommended a complete withdrawal of American troops, which was done by the end of June 1949. They optimistically assumed that the South Koreans could, quote, check and delay any attack by the North Koreans long enough to allow pressure from the United Nations to force a halt. That's from Ronald Steele's essay, Romantic Imperialists. 3 days after the fighting began in Korea, Truman received a cable from General Douglas MacArthur, the American military commander in Japan. MacArthur said that he believed a collapse was imminent. And Truman writes in his memoirs, "There was now no doubt. The Republic of Korea needed help at once if it was not to be overrun. More seriously, a communist success in Korea would put Red troops and planes within easy striking distance of Japan, and Okinawa and Formosa would be open to attack from two sides. I told my advisors that what was developing in Korea seemed to me like a repetition on a larger scale of what had happened in Berlin. The Reds were probing for weaknesses in our armor. We had to meet their thrust without getting embroiled in a worldwide war." It has since become clear that Truman and Acheson were concerned not only with the situation in Asia, but also with the situation in Europe.
It's interesting that within about a day or so of the attack, a warning cable went out over State Department wires to embassies around the world, warning American representatives to beware of Soviet aggression and for moves on other fronts. In that sense, having, I think, misinterpreted the initial event in Korea, there was an American response and one of commitment of troops which was disproportionate to the event and proved only to get us unnecessarily bogged down and to intervene in fact in what was not so simply a case of aggression, but rather one of a civil war. I mean, Korea had been artificially divided by the great powers. South Korea had talked periodically of attacking North Korea. Sigmund Rhee probably would have attacked if he'd had the organized forces and the equipment. We purposely had not given him enough equipment because we feared he might attack. He was clearly a totalitarian dictator. And we entered into the situation with the attack, having misinterpreted it, and then after initial successes in Korea, decided to try to resolve the problems of Korea and to extend American influence by unifying the nation, or to put it more bluntly, by extirpating the North Korean regime.
The political and military goals of American involvement in Korea changed as that involvement continued. In June, the United Nations Security Council had called upon the North Koreans to withdraw to the 38th parallel, the line which divided the two countries, and American involvement was described as in support of that resolution. By September, MacArthur had been instructed to conduct the necessary military operations to force the North Koreans behind the 38th parallel or to destroy their forces. "If there was no indication," Truman writes in his memoirs, "or threat of entry of Soviet or Chinese communist elements in force, MacArthur was to extend his operations north of the parallel and to make plans for the occupation of North Korea." Writing about this series of events, Ronald Steele says, "With the success of MacArthur's armies, what had begun as a defensive war to defend South Korea was transformed into an offensive war to unite all of Korea and destroy the communist regime in the north." After the North Koreans were turned back by MacArthur's brilliant landing at Incheon, the next decision was whether to penetrate beyond the 38th parallel. Despite opposition from within the State Department, the administration was intoxicated by the brilliant possibilities then opening up: the destruction of the North Korean army and the unification of the country. On September 27th, MacArthur was given new instructions to cross the parallel and destroy the North Korean army, provided that Soviet or Chinese troops did not enter the war or threaten to do so. General Marshall, then Secretary of Defense, even sent MacArthur a telegram saying, "We want you to feel unhampered tactically and strategically to proceed north of the 38th parallel." The administration submitted a new resolution to the United Nations, which dutifully approved it on October 7th, calling for a unified, independent, and democratic government of Korea, though the resolution did not explicitly authorize crossing the parallel. As Allied troops approached the parallel, China voiced increasing concern. In mid-September, Peking declared that it would stand by the Korean people and criticized the United States for supporting Chiang Kai-shek and blocking China's admission to the United Nations. On September 30th, Foreign Minister Zhou Enlai stated that the Chinese would not, quote, supinely tolerate seeing their neighbors savagely invaded by the imperialists, close quote, and would not stand aside if the parallel were crossed. On October 1st, South Korean troops moved across the parallel, and MacArthur demanded the unconditional surrender of North Korea. Zhou informed the Indian ambassador that if American troops followed across the parallel, China would enter the war. The message was relayed to Washington on October 3, but dismissed by Acheson. Zhou's warning was ignored, the Indian diplomat was written off as an alarmist and communist sympathizer, and United States troops